You're listening to a message from Southland Church. To learn more about Southland, including our service times and upcoming events, listen to us online at mysouthland.com. Today's message comes from our executive pastor, Eric Klippenstein.
I just realized something as I came up here. I realized that this is one of the few times that Stefan isn't wearing his knee braces, and it's because he's not speaking. I'm pretty sure that's the reason. So if I could borrow those, that'd be terrific. I could use them. Well, good morning. I know this is a long weekend, and you've taken the time and the effort to come out and attend in person here. And I know a lot of you who are enjoying the long weekend are also watching online, so thank you. I look around at the congregation, and I see friends, I see family, I see colleagues, I see a lot of people that I know, people that have known me for a long time. But I'll let you know a little about myself. Ange and I have been married for 38 years. We have three sons, Alan, Michael, and Brendan, along with the daughters that we gained through their marriage. It's Amanda, Danny, and Andrea. And between the six of them, they've managed to give us five grandchildren so far, a little ahead of you, Stefan. With another one on the way for September. We call him Baby K. That's my family. This morning, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about who I am. And I'm going to share some key moments from my life that have been critical in building my faith. It's my story, but I'm going to tell you why it should matter to you. First question I have to ask is, what is the basis for faith? For any faith, why would anyone choose to believe in anything at all? Is faith a function of culture? Is it just part of our heritage? Is it adopted with very little thought? What I believe must answer three basic questions. It doesn't matter whether it's a belief system, whether it's a faith, or whether you would call it a worldview. And these three questions are, where did I come from? Why am I here? What's gone wrong with this world? And what can we do to fix it? See, all these questions establish identity. It establishes where you come from. We're familiar with that growing up in this territory. You meet someone new, what's your first question? Who's your mom and dad? Who are your grandparents, depending on the generational difference? So we understand our identity matters. Where we come from really matters. And it begins to make sense of what we see. When we can answer these questions, that just makes sense. You see, a personal relationship with Jesus Christ is more than just having certain beliefs or believing certain doctrines. It provides a way of understanding all that we see around us. It addresses the world in a consistent, rational way. That is why I believe and hold to a Christian faith. That is why I believe. But I have to ask, what practical value does faith have? I mean, it's great to believe in God, but does it have a practical value? Or is it just something that we hang on to for when we die, kind of like a dim hope of heaven, a bit of an insurance? When I leave this world, I want to know that there's something to go to. But does it have any real practical value for me today? Or should it have any value for me today? I'll give you my answer today through my stories. Let me tell you a little bit about my background. I grew up in rural Manitoba, close to New Bothwell. Yeah, Bothwell cheese. My dad was a construction contractor, and so that was my life growing up. And I remember when I was little, there were three boys in the family and three girls, and the guys had to go along with dad to work. A couple of us in the back of the truck. That was before there were safety regulations. And then you have all these kids running around the job site without safety tools, but that's the way it was. I somehow think it was perhaps more to address mom's sanity than it was to provide practical help for dad, but either way, that's how I grew up, and I learned how to work. But my dad was more than just a contractor. He was also a deacon in the Niverville CMC Church for many, many years. I grew up seeing the value and responsibility of serving in a church. That was part of my environment growing up. But my parents' commitment to their faith was not just Sunday mornings. It was not just church. It was something that affected all of their lives. I saw it intentionally modeled, and it was communicated to us as a family. And I observed how it provided stability, even in the face of stress. That influenced and shaped my life growing up. Early on, I know I had a strong desire to learn and to grow, to understand what's in the Bible and to understand who this God was. I recognize that a large part of that was instilled by my parents. They definitely encouraged it. But as I've grown, I've also learned to recognize that this is the work of the Holy Spirit in my life as well. Philippians 2:13 says, "For God is working in you, giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases him." I was simply responding to the work of the Holy Spirit in my life. In my early youth, I know Dad provided me with a Bible study template. This was long before we had SMORP. But it was a template where I indicated a passage of scripture, indicated who the author was, and what the environment was that this was written in. But it caused me to focus on what am I reading and how does it matter in my life? That taught me to read the Bible in an intentional way. It wasn't just a book, it wasn't just words to gloss over, but it was something that was intended to have an impact on my life. In my youth, I remember thinking quite often that I wanted my faith to be genuine. I wanted to be authentic. And authentic wasn't even a word back in my youth, as it is today. But I didn't want to be superficial. It either mattered or it didn't matter. And if it mattered with everything. Either Jesus is Lord or he's not Lord. Now, one of the things I recognize is that that journey to Jesus being Lord doesn't happen in a day. It's a lifetime of learning to grow in obedience to him. But it has to start with an intentional decision. Is Jesus going to be my Lord, or am I going to run my own life? That came to a fork in the road for me in the summer between my grade 11 and grade 12. That goes back quite a few years, but I remember it. I was fortunate enough to spend a summer in Germany. I was attending the Goethe Institute of Language, and I was taking my grade 12 German credit there. Speak to me in German now, and I probably won't have a clue what you're talking about, but it earned me a credit, which was important. So here I was, a 17-year-old. I was across the ocean away from home, free to do whatever I wanted. I mean, what can go wrong with that story? No watching eyes. I could choose to be good. I could choose to be bad. No one would judge me. They didn't know me. So I recall one night, I had had way too much to drink. And I recall waking up the next morning, it was still morning, and I woke up, but I recognized something significant had happened. I recognized that I was at a crossroads in my life, that I had to make a decision in what path I was going to choose. I could continue to follow my desires and do the things that I thought would make me happy, or I could choose to submit to Jesus Christ as Lord. It couldn't be both. You know, it's interesting. When you get to do whatever you want, suddenly you realize it's not actually what you want. But I chose, I'm all in. Jesus Christ is going to be Lord of my life. I established who had absolute authority in my life. No immediate perfection, I'm sorry to say, but I slowly began to grow in character. Philippians 3:12 says, I don't mean to say that I have already achieved these things or that I have already reached perfection, but I press on to possess that perfection for which Christ Jesus first possessed me. So like Paul, I recognized that this journey is taken one step at a time. It's a process of learning, of applying, and of growing in obedience to Jesus Christ as Lord. But along this journey, I got to know who God is, and I got to learn to trust in Him. Trust and faith are interesting words. We use those a lot in church. But when I think about how would I define them, sometimes that becomes a bit problematic. Are they the same thing? Do they have similar meanings? I know we use them interchangeably. Well, Proverbs 3 verse 5 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not depend on your own understanding. And then Hebrews 11 talks about faith. Faith shows the reality of what we hope for. It is the evidence of things we cannot see. So really what this is saying, faith is trusting in someone or something that you cannot explicitly prove. Now we're all familiar with the trust fall exercise. That's where you turn your back to your friends and you're gonna fall back and you have faith that they will catch you. In fact, your belief is that they will catch you. But that still isn't trust until you actually let yourself go and see what happens. See, trust demonstrates the reality of faith. If I say I have faith in God, that I have confidence in Him, then my life should show that confidence. If I am living in continual fear of everything that's happening around me, that doesn't show a lot of confidence in the God that I say is sovereign and in control. Jeremiah 17, 7 to 8 say, but blessed are those who trust in the Lord and have made the Lord their hope and confidence. They are like trees planted along a riverbank with roots that reach deep into the water. Such trees are not bothered by the heat or worried by long months of drought. Their leaves stay green and they never stop producing fruit. Those words are pretty easy to read. And sometimes I gloss over the fact that the second part of verse 8 talks about heat. It talks about drought. What it's talking about is exposure to stress. I don't know an awful lot about plants, but I know this thing. If I never expose them to stress, their roots don't grow deeper. Deep roots matter. So who or what am I trusting in that's trustworthy? What is the object of my trust? We hear a lot about political parties, and if we just change political parties, then things would work out well. We trust the right political party. Or we trust in our skills and abilities that somehow we're going to be able to figure a way through whatever we encounter. Or we trust in our finances that we have enough reserve that should be able to take us through. Or it may be that we're enjoying good health and we say, you know, if as long as I have my health, I'm good to go. We all trust in something. The question is who or what? What are you trusting in that gives you confidence to face life? I like to think of this illustration. Let's say I'm going to rappel down the face of a cliff. I've seen it done on pictures, on movies, where you attach your rope to something and then you start rappelling over the face of the cliff and you work your way down the cliff. Now let me ask you something. Does it matter how that rope is tied? I would say it does. And does it matter what it's tied to? Well, unless you want a really quick journey down the face of that cliff, I think it does. You want it tied to something unmovable. But this isn't a new question. If I take you all the back to 700 BC, we come across a story the king of Israel is rebelling against the kingdom of Assyria. The kingdom of Assyria is in control of the entire land, and the king of Israel, who is ruling on behalf of Assyria, decides that they're going to rebel against Assyria. And so then Sennacherib comes out to meet Hezekiah. He's coming to deal with the situation. And Hezekiah is safely holed up in the city of Jerusalem, but he's refusing to surrender. 2 Kings 18:19 begins with the story. And then the Assyrian king's chief of staff told them to give this message to Hezekiah. This is what the great king of Assyria says. What are you trusting in that makes you so confident? See, it's pretty easy to determine what confidence Sennacherib had. He had power and authority. He was in charge. He had armies, he had chariots, he had horsemen. He had proven victories over many other nations' gods. He had a lot to have confidence in. What about Hezekiah? Well, he didn't have any of those. So what did he have? He had faith in God. That just doesn't seem like a fair match, does it? I mean, the basis for Sennacherib's confidence was visible. In fact, it was spread out across the entire valley. The basis for Hezekiah's confidence was an unseen, invisible God. So let me ask you this question. How does faith in an unseen, invisible God have any value? Well, let me tell you a story from my life. I finished high school. Soon after high school, in my early 20s, I married a girl named Eva Fair. I was 20 years old. I was really mature back then. We grew up way faster back then. At 20, if you weren't already married, you gotta wonder. We had an apartment. We had jobs that we mostly enjoyed. We had enough finances to meet our needs. We led a youth group in our local church. We were involved. And we were growing in our relationship with God. Life was really quite easy. You know, it's difficult to recognize a need for God when everything is easy. I had a faith yet untested and did not yet recognize the value of it. In late 1984, we found out we were pregnant. Now we really had it all. We had a loving relationship, finances, faith, and now the dream of starting a family. It actually checked all the boxes for living the good life. Things were coming along just fine. Then we moved to early spring of 1985. We had a conference youth retreat. I was up at Sandy Lake Bible Camp down in Fauston, Minnesota. The speaker for this conference was Dr. Gus Konkel from Providence Seminary. And he was speaking from the strange book of Habakkuk. This was my first introduction to it. I mean, you think it's a youth retreat. You're gonna speak from one of the minor prophets in Habakkuk? Seemed odd. But I'll tell you the story. Habakkuk is a prophet, and God is telling him about a coming disaster that's coming for Judah. Right now, you look at Judah, they're independent, they're prosperous, but they're going to be overrun by Babylon. They will lose everything they have. They will lose their freedom, and many of them will lose their lives. I was challenged by this story. It really grabbed my heart. But what I was especially challenged by was Habakkuk's response to this impending doom. I see that in Habakkuk 3, 16 to 19. I trembled inside when I heard this. This is Habakkuk speaking. My lips quivered with fear. My legs gave way beneath me and I shook in terror. And then he declares, even though the fig trees have no blossoms and there are no grapes on the vines, even though the olive crop fails and the fields lie empty and barren. Even though the flocks die in the fields and the cattle barns are empty, yet I will trust in the Lord. I will be joyful in the God of my salvation. The sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes me as sure-footed as a deer, able to head to tread upon the heights. Wow. I mean, that is amazing faith. Yes, he's fearful. He recognizes what's coming, but he commits that even though all these things are coming, yet he will be joyful in God and he will trust God for the strength to carry on. How do you trust God in the midst of chaos? Is that even possible? It was hard for me to relate to. I mean, I had no impending doom in my life, yet I was impressed. And I clearly recall God asking me a question at this point. You know when he's asking you a question. And he was asking me, I see you're impressed by Habakkuk's response. Now let me ask you this question. Will you be just as unwavering in your commitment to me, that you will trust me no matter what? Well, I'd never considered the impact of faith in hard times. I mean, faith is believing correctly, doing the right things, not doing the wrong things. Faith had to do with determining how to live in order to get to heaven. That's faith. But now he's asking, was I prepared to trust, even in difficulty, like Habakkuk? My response? Absolutely. I mean, what's not to trust? How hard can it be? It's easy to answer when everything is going well, when you're living on the mountaintops. But the desire to trust is a great start. But it has to be walked out. Let me give you an example. Let's say I build a high bridge over a raging river. I managed to get it done, and I invite you to come and look at the work that I have done. And so you see it stretching across this huge cavern, and you say, wow, that is amazing. Looks super strong. I say, well, do you think it would carry a person? And you say, oh, yes, absolutely. I fully believe that. And then I say, who wants to be the first to cross it? You do, yes, absolutely. No fear of death. Well, that's where trust comes in. It's one thing to have faith. It's another thing to have trust. So June 5th, 1985 came along. Our baby was about to be born, and we headed off on an early morning drive to Victoria General Hospital in Winnipeg. If you recall the first trip to the hospital for the firstborn of your family, you'll recall what that was like. A lot of excitement. Back then, you got to stay in the hospital a few days when you had a baby, and so she stayed a few more days, and on June 7th, I was visiting her again. And we landed on a name for our son. We called him Alan Scott. With a last name like Klippenstein, you tend to keep the first one short. So Alan Scott it was. Eva was tired, and we made arrangements that I was going to pick her up the next day, and I was going to take her and Alan home. So I stopped by my mom and dad's on the way home. They live close to New Bothwell, and we lived in Mitchell. It was a time of excitement. You know what that's like. A lot of congratulations, food, just a ton of excitement. When I arrived home, I heard the phone ringing in the house. I was still in the garage, and you know, I can still recall that sound to this very day. It was a hospital calling, and they were saying that things weren't going well for Eva, that it was critical that I get back there immediately. I did. When I got to the hospital, they informed me that Eva had passed away. Life became surreal at this point. this is not the future that I had planned. My plans were entirely different. So here I was, alone in Eva's hospital room, and I had a lot of questions, a lot of whys. God, why would you allow my young wife, the mother of our son, to die? God, we loved each other. We loved you. We served you. Should there not be a reward for living right? Why was I not left alone to raise my son? But I was getting no answers. But suddenly God was asking me a question. If that sounds familiar, think of Job 38. He also has lots of questions for God, and God stops him, and he asks him a question. And he gets to the essence of the issue. He says, if you can't possibly understand the intricate workings of creation, how can you possibly understand my mind, my character, my ways? Our only option is to submit to his authority and rest in his care. You see, when God asked me a question, my questions no longer mattered. So the question he asked me was this: do you recall our conversation a few months ago when I asked you if you would trust me? No matter what. I recall that clearly. He said, you said yes, you would trust. He said, now your world has fallen apart. Your world is shattered. Do you still commit to trusting me, even now? You see, that's an important decision. You know, a relationship with God is nice. When everything is going well, it's just nice. It's not essential, but it's really nice. But now I needed a God who was strong, who was compassionate, who'd provide a foundation for me, and who would guide me through the storm that I was facing. A God that I could trust to take me through the days ahead. Psalm 34, verse 8 says, taste and see that the Lord is good. Oh, the joys of those who take refuge in him. Well, I desperately needed a God to take refuge in. 1 Peter 5, 7 says, give all your cares and worries to God, for he cares about you. I also needed a God who could handle my cares and worries. I recognize he's not oblivious to my pain. And so I committed to trusting him, no matter what. That decision mattered because that was a submission of my will to his. It's not about me. It's about him and his choice for my life. And I recognize that he's wise enough, big enough, and sovereign. He had known this would happen. This didn't come as a surprise to him. Psalm 139, 16 says, you saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. See, we tend to think that our lives will continue in a continuous way, uninterrupted. And perhaps they will. But there's no guarantees. God knows. But he doesn't run ahead of us to remove any difficulties and challenges from our lives. Death and brokenness are part of this natural world. But we can choose to trust. God never left me, but carried me, and I learned things about him that I would never have learned as long as everything was great, as long as everything was easy, because I actually needed him. This was beyond my strength. And I learned valuable lessons through this. I learned that death is a natural part of this world. We see it around us day in and day out. I've learned that life has no guarantees. And I also learned that the relationships that we have ought to be treasured. Value them while you have them, because there are no guarantees. And I learned that my strength is insufficient to face life. You see, loss tests our commitment to God, because we can respond in bitterness, assuming that God owes us a good life. If we live right, he owes us a good life. That he exists to protect us from loss. Truth is dramatically different. We exist for his glory. He doesn't exist to give us the good life. But he's focused on preparing us for the eternity that extends beyond these few short years. So I will trust in the even those of this life. Philippians 4:11-13 says, "Not that I was ever in need, for I have learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I have learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or with little. For I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength." So God provided that foundation for me from which to get up. I recognize that God gives me everything I need. He doesn't necessarily give me everything I want, but he gives me everything I need. Only Jesus is essential. God is good. I often reflect on the fact that he actually prepared my heart in advance for what I was about to face. He brought me to the point of needing to make a commitment before I actually recognized why. See, often we want to tell him our yes after we know the outcome. But that's not really faith then, is it? We give him our yes, trusting him for the outcome. But that's not the end of my story. That is pretty close to the beginning of my story. But that provided a very new understanding of what my relationship with God was to be like and who he was in the midst of that relationship. You see, Eva's life had ended. Her journey here on earth was done. Mine was not. I had a son to raise, and I had to recognize that my journey was going to continue on without her. By God's grace, Ange soon came into my life. We've now been married since 1986. Proverbs 18:22 says, "The man who finds a wife finds a treasure, and he receives favor from the Lord." I have favor, and just proof. I consider one great marriage to be an incredible blessing. Some don't have that experience. I got to experience it not once, but twice. I know at the time, some people would ask my dad, they would say, "You know, don't you think it's a bit soon for Eric to be remarrying?" And Dad had an answer. He said, "Have you been praying for Eric that he would find a new wife and a mother for Alan?" And they said, "Oh, yes, they had been praying." And he said, "Now do you have a problem with God's timing?" They didn't. So often we think we know what God's timing ought to be like, and we challenge him in that. But it wasn't too soon. But now this was not just my faith journey. This is also Angie's faith journey. You see, God had told her that she would date and marry me. Well, think about it. You got a young widower, an infant son, in a small community, and he's now dating. That immediately puts you into a fishbowl. Under the watching eyes of the community, wagging tongues, you can't walk by without having people turn and whisper to each other, because everybody knows this is a widower. A handsome widower, by the way, just so you know. So we were the talk of the town. And Ange required her trust in God's provision and plan for her life to give her stability through this, to give her stability through public scrutiny. She would much rather have done without that. We were welcomed into the Fair family. That also was God's grace extended to the watching community. Mom Isaac was very instrumental in this. Amazing woman. Think about it. This is a mother who has just lost a daughter. Her son-in-law is now getting remarried and bringing another woman into his family. How is she going to respond? This was her response. This is my Ange. This is my daughter. That is grace. We were family. We were loved. Sometimes people would ask her, you know, even in the years that passed, you know, do you still see Eric and Ange? Or do you still see Eric? And she would say, absolutely, they're my kids. Three immediate families, which we continue to be close to. Our kids grew up having three sets of grandparents and lots of uncle and aunts. Only a loving God could have prepared me in advance by inviting me into a relationship with him. Only a loving God could have convinced a 20-year-old, Ange, to marry a widower, to accept the challenge of an immediate family in the face of public scrutiny. And only a loving God could have given us the continued grace into the Fair family. We were blessed with two more sons and the daughters we gained through marriage and the grandkids that eventually followed. This lesson from my 20s solidified my understanding of and commitment to a God I know I can trust in uncertainty. I asked, is there any practical value to faith in this life? And you've heard the story from my life, how my faith mattered in one of the toughest moments of my life. Each one of us has or will experience situations, whether that be through relationships, through finances, through health, that we couldn't have predicted or that we can manage on our own. So it's helpful to look around at our loved ones, at the things that we value, at the dreams that we have, and ask, what if? Who is God to you in the face of this unknown? But we get to choose our own ending. We can say, I can manage on my own, and that would be foolish. We can say, God owes me, and that would be incorrect. See, God provides a relationship that gives us the strength to get up and walk through a broken world together with him. We get to choose, and this choice matters a lot. And it's either total commitment or total independence. Choices are great, but the implications of that matter. We get to choose who or what we will trust in. And that choice determines how we move forward. So who or what are you trusting in that gives you confidence to face an unknown future? The message of Habakkuk is, regardless what I will encounter, I will still trust in God. He is my joy and my strength and confidence. He is why we can stand up in the middle of hard times with absolute confidence that we are not standing alone. He will walk with us and carry us if needed, but won't leave us on our own. So that shifts my focus from these few short years on this life to the eternity beyond. Only an amazing God would love us and care enough about us to deepen our relationship with him through the hard times that we walk through. As I stand here today, I still have no idea what the days ahead look like, no more than I did in 1985. None of us do. However, I have a much better understanding of who it is that walks through this life with me. The object of my faith matters. I know who I'm anchored in. But that same question that Sennacherib asked Hezekiah, I'm now asking you 2,700 years later. Who or what are you trusting in that gives you confidence to face life ahead? You can choose to fully submit your life to Jesus as Lord, or you can choose to go it on your own. Jeremiah 17:7 says, "But blessed are those who trust in the Lord and have made the Lord their hope and confidence." If this has challenged you in any way, or if you need prayer for anything else, head over to the prayer room after the service and somebody will be happy to pray with you there.
If today's message has encouraged you, please take a moment to rate us and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream podcasts. For access to previous messages, videos, and live services, visit us online at myselfland.com or download the Selfland Church app. Thank you again for tuning in to this week's message.